Footprints Fadeless by Mary Baker Eddy. Background remarks. The following two documents are on file in the Congressional Library, Washington, D.C. 3883, February the 13th, 1902, Pleasant View, Concord, New Hampshire, February 12th, 1903. Dear Sir, Librarian of Congress, Washington, D.C., please issue a copyright for title and contents of a book entitled Footprints Fadeless by Mary Baker G. Eddy, in favor of Mary Baker G. Eddy, its author, who is a resident of the United States. All right reserved by the author. Yours respectfully, Calvin A. Fry. Signed. Certified February the 21st, 1902. Mailed. Footprints Fadeless by Mary Baker G. Eddy, author of Science and Health, with Key to the Scriptures, and Pastor Emeritus of the First Church of Christ Scientist Boston. Published by Joseph Armstrong, 95 Falmouth Street, 1902. There is also a reference to Footprints Fadeless in a letter which Mrs. Eddy wrote to William D. McCracken during 1902. She stated that she did not want it known as yet that she had written it, but that it was a record of her early history. The copyright has now expired, and it is fitting to preface the text with the same dedication and verses which Mrs. Eddy used while she still wished it kept hidden in sacred secrecy from the world. To the patient, glad toilers in the vineyard of our Lord, I lovingly dedicate my footprints. Mary Baker Eddy. Footprints at perhaps another, sailing o'er life's solemn main, a forlorn and shipwrecked brother, seeing, shall take heart again. Longfellow, a psalm for life. Oh, sometimes gleams upon our sight, through present wrongs the eternal right, and step by step since time began, we see the steady gain of man. Whittier, Old and New. A Significant Life. I have been asked so frequently for the names of my first students and for jottings from the early history of Christian Science that my first spare moments are employed to copy briefly from old manuscripts, prints, letters, and from memory, the following incidents in the course of my experience of the rebirth of an idea which vibrates in unison with divine order. Very early in life, there was a demand for my literary productions. When about 18 years of age, I wrote for the Belknap Gazette, published in New Hampshire, and later for the New Hampshire Patriots. After an academic course, I graduated under Professor Dyer H. Sanborn, the celebrated author of Sanborn's Grammar. Later, I wrote for the leading magazines of the South, and on my return to the North after the death of my beloved husband, Colonel Glover, I was offered an annual salary of $3,000, by the editor of the Odd Fellows magazine, published by the U.S. Lodge. Other leading magazines, both North and South, have allowed me to name my salary and never objected to paying it. If all my poems from early years, which have appeared in public print, were collected, they would fill a good-sized volume. My miscellaneous writings, gathered in book form, in 1897 has passed its 42nd edition of 1,000 copies each. And the Christian Science textbook, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, of which I am the author, has reached its 225th edition of 1,000 copies each. I have lectured in large crowded halls at Portland, Waterville, Maine, Boston, Massachusetts, Providence, Rhode Island, New York City, Washington, D.C., and Chicago. In 1846, the Reverend Richard S. Rust, D.D., at that time principal of the Methodist Conference Seminary in Northfield, New Hampshire, asked me to supply the place of his principal female teacher during her absence for a few weeks. Among other pleasant memories of that occasion, I recall entering a classroom one day and finding on the blackboard a fine compliment to Mrs. Glover, written by the professor. Colonel George W. Glover. My first husband, Colonel George W. Glover of Charleston, S.C., was at Wilmington, N.C., attending to business when he was seized with yellow fever and died in that city. I was with him, watched day and night at his bedside in speechless woe, till he passed the dark shadow. My name was his last word. The interest manifested in his recovery by the Freemasons and the citizens was unsurpassed. He was a Royal Archmason and buried with Masonic honors. A great procession followed his remains. His body was not allowed to be taken to our beautiful home in Charleston, S.C., owing to fear of contagion, but marked respect and affection were bestowed to his memory. The Wilmington city officials took possession of the body, the lodge and chapter of which he was a member in Charleston, S.C., passed resolutions of sorrow and condolence, and wore the usual badge of mourning. He was a Master Mason in St. Andrew's Lodge No. 10 of Charleston, S.C. On my departure for the North, the governor of the state and his staff, together with the Reverend Repperton, an Episcopal clergyman, and other Freemasons, attended me to the station and engaged a brother Mason to accompany me to my father's house in New Hampshire, giving him strict charge concerning my safety and comfort during the journey. My husband was said to own much property in slaves, but I did not sell them after his decease. Although agreeing with Southrons as to racial distinctions, such as nature constitutes, yet I never could feel that I owned property in a human being. The following is a brief extract from a glowing tribute to Colonel Glover, which appeared in the Masonic magazine. He was devotedly attached to Masonry, faithful as a member and officer of the lodge and chapter, and beloved by his brothers and companions who mourn his early death. He had been instructed how to live and how to die, and that instruction had been sealed to his heart. He departed in that hope and peace. He was our brother. He had gone at the call of our father. Although we lament his departure from the territorial lodge, we trust we shall meet him in the celestial grand lodge, where our work will be perfect, our refreshments divine. A distinguished dentist. My second husband, Daniel Patterson, DDS, was appointed by Governor Berry of New Hampshire to go to the South and disburse to loyal Southerners some government fees. Dr. Patterson was not a soldier, but a citizen prisoner. In 1873, while he was in Littleton, New Hampshire, I obtained a divorce from him for adultery. Mr. R.D. Rounsville, proprietor of the White Mountain House, White Mountains, N.H., writes. About the year 1874, Dr. Daniel Patterson, a dentist, boarded with me in Littleton, New Hampshire. During his stay at different times, I had conversation with him about his wife, from whom he was separated. He spoke of her as being a pure and Christian woman, and that the cause of the separation was wholly on his part, that if he had done as he ought, he might have had as pleasant and happy a home as one could wish for. At that time I had no knowledge of who his wife was. Later on I learned that Mary Baker G. Eddy, the discoverer and founder of Christian Science, was the above-mentioned woman. Signed, R.D. Rounsville, January the 18th, 1902. Mental healing in the 50s. In the 50s, Mrs. Smith of Rumsey, New Hampshire, came to me with her infant, whose eyes were diseased, a mass inflammation, neither pupil nor iris discernible. I gave the infant no drugs, held her in my arms for a few moments, while lifting my thoughts to God, then returned the babe to her mother healed. In grateful memory thereof, Mrs. Smith named her babe Mary, and embroidered a petticoat for me. I have carefully preserved that garment to this day. This simple case of mental healing occurred in the 50s, before I saw P.P. Quimby, and before I gave up the practice of homeopathy, on the conviction that mind, more than matter, is the Aesculapius. I would limit my philanthropy sooner than harm a child. The children are blessed above others by Christian Science. It heals them sooner than it can adults. It relieves them from nauseous lotions and big pills. They become good healers sooner than do adults, for they are nearer the kingdom of heaven. The child of 7 years old may become the family physician. It is a children's native element. In it, they revel in the liberty of health and divine love. Let the children speak for themselves on this subject. General Benjamin F. Butler's letter. I here quote an interesting correspondence which passed between General Benjamin F. Butler and myself in 1861. The general's original letter is in my possession. Romney, New Hampshire, August 17, 1861, General Benjamin F. Butler. My dear sir, permit me individually and as the representative of thousands of my sex in your native state to tender the homage and gratitude due to you, one of her noblest sons who so bravely vindicated the claims of humanity in your late letter to Secretary Cameron. You dared to assume in the dignity of defending with your latest breath our country's honor, a position of justice and equity, the final solution of the great national query. Will freedom be rendered to black as well as white, men, women, and children whom you have the courage and honor to defend in this, the hour of our country's pain? And purification must soon follow. You hold freedom to be the normal condition of those made in God's image. So do we all. In this, the man can only equal the soldier who offers his life for his country, and by fairness and argument elucidates the justice, which will surely transmit to posterity the success of a republican form of government in heritage perpetual, undimmed in its lustre. The red strife between right and wrong will be fierce, but it cannot be long, and victory on the side of immutable justice will be well worth its cost. But I will not ask your time or forbearance, Father. Your act is thrilled with electric hope, the homes and hearts of this section of our country, hope in God and in right. Give us in the field and on the forum men like our brave Ben Butler, and our country is saved. Respectfully, Mary M. Patterson. To this letter, General Butler responded in the following words: Headquarters, Department of Virginia, Madame, in reply to your favor of the 17th, I am directed by the general in command to express the 1,000 obligations he is under for your kind expressions, sympathy, and consideration. The discharge of public duty is made easy by such commendations coming from the noble and the loyal of the land. I have the honor to be, very respectfully, your servant, P. Haggerty, aide-de-camp to Major Gen. Butler. Mary M. Patterson, Romney, New Hampshire. About the year 1863, I lectured at Waterville College in Maine on the subject North and South. Professor Sheldon paid me a high compliment through the newspapers, and the boys in blue serenaded me. It was an occasion not to be forgotten. A magnetic doctor. In 1862, I went from a hydropathic institute to Dr. P.P. Quimby, a magnetic physician. He used no drugs with this exception, his method in no way related to Christian Science. He never intimated to me in 2 years that he treated the sick metaphysically. He did not pray for me when treating me. He talked with me on various subjects, then wet his hand in water and manipulated my head. He helped me for a while, but failed to cure me. He had almost no book learning, but advanced views on his subject of magnetic practice. He was not scientific. He was not a Christian Scientist. My complete departure from his practice is proven in that the first students in Christian Science tried to demonstrate my teachings after Quimby's method. But Christian Science could neither be demonstrated thus nor by any material method. Christ was and is my only teacher of Christian Science. We have no record that Jesus described disease, but he healed it. I taught students in Christian Science not to describe disease, but to heal it, whereas Mr. Quimby, after manipulating his patients, retired to record the description of the parson and of the disease. I once asked him to show me his description of my case. I read it and returned it to him. While under Mr. Quimby's treatment, he frequently asked me to look over his scribblings and put them in grammatical form. This I did. Also, I wrote manuscript copies of my own and left them with him. I had no occasions or incentive to steal his thunder. My first student will say I never taught him what is contained in the chapter Recapitulation. That's from the final form of the Science of Man, with which the early students were taught in Science and Health. I failed to state Christian Science fully until I had written Science and Health in 1875, 9 years after the death of Mr. Quimby. The Science of Man was written in Lynn about 1870. It was my own composition, and I prepared it for a class I taught. In what I wrote, I sought to express what I had discovered, but failing at first to do this, learned to labour and wait for more fitness to express an awkward spiritual sense of what the infinite subject of Christian Science contains. I could not have written Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures sooner than I did. Ask any loyal student today if he could learn Christian Science as I now teach it from the manuscripts I wrote for my first students, or if he could demonstrate it by manipulation or by electricity. What would his answer be? This is my proof that Mr. Quimby's scribblings and his treatment of the sick were mental leagues apart from Christian Science. I refer to these facts in my preface in Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures. The copies that I have seen purporting to be originally his are chiefly plagiarisms from my private manuscripts and copyrighted works. Quimby believed that matter is as real as spirit, and that sin, disease, death, and contagion are real. In Christian Science, all are spirit and spiritual. There is no matter, no contagion, sin, disease, death. God is all in all, infinite. And the infinite can know nothing and cause nothing apart from the nature of the infinite. I had dropped the subject relating to a fossilized falsehood, but evidence and testimony on the side of truth are always in order and proverbially better last than never. Hence, I republish from the Christian Science Journal an extract from the following letter mailed to me by a student. It might be interesting for you to know that Mr. A.J. Swartz of Chicago went to see the late Dr. P.P. Quimby's son and procured his father's writings for the purpose of having them published in order to show the world that your ideas were borrowed from Quimby. After having examined them, it was found there was nothing that would compare in any way to Science and Health, and he concluded that it would aid you too much to publish them, so they were returned to the owner. Mrs. Schwartz saw and read these manuscripts, and she gave me this information. Mary H. Philbrick, Austin, Illinois, May 18, 1892. The following letter is republished from the Christian Science Journal of November 1886, an attested statement in reference to Dr. Quimby's method of healing the sick. I was treated by Dr. P.P. Quimby in Portland for neuralgia in the head. Mrs. Eddy was also a patient of his. I first met her there, and it was in the summer of 1862. His mode of treating the sick was to immerse his hands in water and manipulate their heads. My father, W.P. Morgan, offered him $1,000 to explain his method of treating disease, to which the doctor replied, "I cannot. I do not understand it myself." I never knew of his attempting to teach anyone. His method was entirely different from Mrs. Eddy's system of Christian Science. Mrs. E. A. Thompson, witness: we concur in affirming the known truth of the above statements Mrs. A.D. Morgan, W.P. Morgan, A.M., and Mrs. A.R. Rutten. Minneapolis, Minnesota, September 1886. I wish to add to the above statement that I was acquainted with Mr. Quimby for years, and I never heard him say that God heals his patients. He gave me no spiritual explanation of the scriptures, while Mrs. Eddy's teachings and writings contain little else. I first met Mrs. Mary Baker G. Eddy in Dr. Quimby's office at the hotel in Portland, M.E. He was not a teacher of her method, neither did he use the pathological system originated by her. In 1886, Mrs. Eddy taught me Christian Science, and she taught me to overcome evil with good, never to harm others. I have practiced Christian Science 15 years, and I know it to be far above that which Mr. Quimby talked, wrote, and practiced as the heavens are above the earth. I did not regain my health until after I learned Christian Science. Emma A. Thompson. The following offer first appeared in the Boston Post and the Boston Traveler in 1887. It has never been accepted. To whom it may concern, Mr. George A. Quimby, son of the late Phineas P. Quimby, over his own signature and before witness, stated in 1883 that he had in his possession at that time all the manuscripts that had been written by his father, and I hereby declare that to expose the falsehood of parties publicly imitating that I have appropriated matter belonging to the aforesaid Quimby, I will pay the cost of printing and publishing the first edition of those manuscripts with the author's name attached. Provided that I am allowed first to examine said manuscripts and to find that they were his own compositions and not mine, that were left with him many years ago, or that they have not since his death in 1866 been stolen from my published works. Also that I am given the right to bring out this one edition under the copyright of the owner of said manuscripts, and all the money accruing from the sales of said book shall be paid to said owner. Some of his purported writings, quoted by Mr. D., were my own works, as near as I can recollect them. There is a great demand for my work, Science and Health, with key to the scriptures. Hence Mr. D.'s excuse for the delay to publish Quimby's manuscript, namely, that this period is not sufficiently enlightened to be benefited by them. Question mark is lost, for if I have copied from Quimby and my book is accepted, it has created a demand for his. Mary Baker G. Eddy. Boston Traveler, May 21st, 1887. When I knew him, Mr. Quimby had not learned the psalmist's secret of health and holiness, but we trust he now knows it and is the redeemed of divine love. Many were his virtues. Let us tread lightly on his ashes. Mrs. Mary Baker's letter. Mrs. Baker is the widow of my eldest brother. Her maiden name was Cook. She was the Mary A. Cook who wrote the History of the Judsons and was often referred to with an approval in the Missionary Herald. Her life is a grand psalm. She writes as follows. Reverend Irving C. Tomlinson, Concord, New Hampshire. Dear Sir, at this time when so much is being said in public, most appreciatively of the Reverend Mary Baker G. Eddy, discoverer and founder of Christian Science, and also somewhat that is untruthful, absurd, and wholly unchristian, I desire to make the following statement. First, I will say that I am not a Christian Scientist, but am of the Orthodox faith, and for more than half a century have been a member of the Park Street Congregational Church in Boston, Massachusetts. My beloved husband, long since passed to his rest, was Mrs. Eddy's oldest brother, and I know the facts of her life as no one can know them who is not thus allied in kinship and family history. The church and faith that were ours were hers also until 1866. Her early bereavement was followed by a long illness, when failing to be healed by medical skill. She felt there must be something outside the ordinary methods of healing. After much study of the Bible, for which she isolated herself for years, she came to the conclusion it is God that does all. Acting on this faith, she was able, through divine help, to recover her health. It is not strange, in view of the frequency of failure by the medical fraternity to restore their patients to health, that other means should be sought. While I am not a believer in the entirety of Christian Science, I do believe that God is able to heal us physically and spiritually if we confide in His love and trust in Him for all our needs, whether logical is truth or otherwise. Christian Science is her faith, sincerely embraced after long years of faithful study of the Bible, and according to her belief, it is intelligently taught. She is now, and has been for 35 years, hard at work in the cause she espouses. With her means, she is carrying blessings to many a needy one, and she works on, seeking the good of all. Whatever differences of belief the public may entertain concerning any of her doctrines, they cannot justly ignore the fact that hers is an earnest, generous, and noble life, the legitimate outgrowth of a noble soul. Mrs. Eddy's character is above reproach. No libelous words can touch it, no foe can assail it. Hidden in God it shall shine, and reflecting Him, its brilliancy will be seen long after she who labours ceases her work for ultimate rest. Her large and extensive work with her unprecedented following has called forth malignant utterances, so utterly false they should not go unchallenged. I am acquainted with the birth and growth of Christian Science, and know that the claim that it originated with Phineas P. Quimby is absurd and without foundation. I can state positively that Mrs. Eddy never received any instructions or suggestions from him in regard to metaphysical healing or Christian Science. I know whereof I speak, because I accompanied her to Dr. Quimby. At that time she was too feeble to go unattended. His treatment consisted of manipulations in cold water, and was wholly material and entirely devoid of metaphysics or spirituality. Both my husband and myself made careful inquiries in regard to Mr. Quimby's system of treatment while Mrs. Eddy was under his care, and we considered his methods to be the essence of quackery. I also desire to say most emphatically that my sister, Mrs. Eddy, never was a spiritualist. She never held a spiritualistic seance in Boston or anywhere else. I have known her for 50 years and I know that all the charges brought against her are the work of ignorance and malice, and wholly devoid of any semblance of facts. Her great kindness to me can never be forgotten. I pray God to sustain her and to keep her from all harm. A difference in theological views does not call for such treatment as she has received from some who disagree with her. My standing in the Orthodox Church will vouch for the truth of every word I have written in this letter. Perhaps I should say that I was educated for missionary work and early became a member of the American Board of Commissioners of Foreign Missions. I went out as a missionary to labor among the Choctaw Indians at Pine Ridge Seminary, Indian Territory, where I was a principal of that institution. I continued in the missionary field of labor until the failure of my health. In these many years of Christian activity, I was associated with Reverend I.C. Strong and his wife, Reverend Kingsbury and Hodgkins, and other well-known Christian workers. Under great trial and persecution, I feel that Mrs. Eddy has been true to these words which I select from one of her poems, "Oh, make me glad for every scalding tear, for hope deferred and gratitude disdain, wait in love more for every hate and fear, no ill since God is good and loss is gain." Her whole life has been a beautiful exponent of these words from her poem entitled "Christ My Refuge," which I select from a multiplicity of kindred thoughts found in her literary works. "My prayer, some daily good to do, to thine for thee, an offering pure of love whereto God leadeth me. I have written to you in the interest of Christianity, regarding personally known facts, Christianity, whose foundation stones are righteousness, justice, and truth, with the prayer that only the right may triumph. Signed, Mary A. Baker, Boston, Massachusetts, August the 20th, 1901. First student, a living witness. My first student in Christian Science was Mr. Hiram S. Crafts of Stoughton, Massachusetts. I taught him in Lynn, Massachusetts in 1867. Afterwards, he returned to his home in Stoughton, and his wife urgently wrote to me to come to them and help her husband commence practice. I went and remained there about a year, left him with a good practice, and gave him his tuition. Mr. Craft speaks thereof as follows: "I hereby certify that Mrs. Mary Baker G. Eddy, the discoverer and founder of Christian Science, was not a spiritualist when she taught me Christian Science in the year 1867. At that date, I was a spiritualist, but her teachings changed my views on that subject, and I gave up spiritualism. Mrs. Eddy boarded at my house when I resided in Stoughton, Massachusetts. She furnished our parlor and gave us the use of her furniture free of cost while she remained with us. She never taught me in my mental practice to hurt others, but only to heal the sick and reform the sinner. She taught me from the scriptures and from manuscripts that she wrote as she taught me. Signed, Hiram S. Crafts, Concord, New Hampshire, December the 14th, 1901. My third student was Mrs. Sally Wentworth of Stoughton, Massachusetts. She, her husband, Mr. Allenson C. Wentworth, and their daughter Celia have passed away. Hence I have not their testimony on the above subject, which I doubt not they would gladly give. But I have letters in their own handwriting, which show our mutually friendly attitude, both before and after I left them. Mr. Crofts and Mrs. Wentworth's were my only boarding places in Stoughton. I had no acquaintances during my short stay there, except the patients of the aforesaid students. The neighbours at that time were not near, and if I had occasion to go out in the evening, some member of the above-named families always accompanied me. After my return to Lynn, Mrs. Wentworth wrote, requesting me to come to Stoughton and teach her Christian Science. In due time, I went there. When I was ready to leave them, she told me that she earned from her practice $50 per week. I taught Mrs. Wentworth Christian Science more from sympathy than for money, for she had told me that owing to her husband's long illness and inability to work, they were poor. My terms for her tuition were a small percentage of her practice, but I made no demands for this and took no legal action to obtain it. When I was ready to return to Lynn, Mr. Wentworth took me to the depot and thanked me cordially for what I had done for himself and his family. On my arrival at Lynn, when unpacking my trunk, I missed some articles I had forgotten and had left in the closet in the chamber that I occupied. I informed Mrs. Wentworth of it, naming the articles. One was a pair of boots, and requested her to send them to me at her earliest convenience. She sent them in good condition. The floor of my room was not carpeted. Pretty homemade rugs cheered it. After I left them, I received the following certificate and letters in their own handwriting, the originals of which I possess. I cheerfully give my testimonial to the wonderful efficacy of the science Mrs. Glover teaches in its application to my case. I was the melancholy victim of sciatica in the hip for many years. At times I could neither lie, sit, or stand without great suffering. When I first saw Mrs. Glover, she told me she could cure me, but I must say it seemed impossible after suffering so long and trying so many things, that I could be healed without medicine or application of any sort. Yet such was the case. After she had conversed with me, I improved until my hip disease left me, and I am completely rid of it. Signed, Allenson C. Wentworth, Stoughton, Massachusetts, 1873. I was also cured of an invertebrate habit of smoking and chewing tobacco. A.C. Wentworth. The following is the daughter's letter. Stoughton, March 16th, 1868. Dear Mrs. Patterson, we received your letter February 6. Father and mother have been teasing me to write to you ever since. I am ashamed because I have not written before. I read your letter before breakfast, then sat up and ate and drank with the rest, and have ever since. Before that, I had been living on toasted bread and going all day without drink. You don't know how much good your letter did me. How can I ever repay you for all you've done for me. I will send you some money in this letter, but that won't begin to pay you. But it is the best I can do this time. Mother said if I would begin a letter, she would finish it. So I leave the rest for her to write. Yours with love, Celia. Dear Mrs. Patterson, I will tell you all the news I can think of. Hiram Craft's wife made us a call last Sunday. He says he has not given up doctoring. James Atherton's wife is dead. Funeral yesterday. Mrs. Holbrook and daughter are well. E. Briggs' stable was burnt a few weeks ago. E. Tucker's shop was burnt 2 weeks since. Another house owned by the Irish in the same neighbourhood all burned to the ground. Three other buildings were set on fire, but extinguished before much damage was done. Folks think there is danger of being burnt out to live in Stoughton Corner. We see C. A. French almost every week. He is quite smart. He thinks coming here does him good. We all feel very thankful to you. Your letters do us a great deal of good. Signed, S. Wentworth. Upon severing my connection with my dear old church in Tilton, New Hampshire, I received the following letter of dismissal from my pastor, January 13th, 1875. This certifies that Mrs. Mary M. Glover is a member of this church in good and regular standing. At her own request, she is dismissed from this and recommended to any evangelical church in Lynn. When received there, her particular connection with us will cease. Theodore C. Pratt, pastor of the Congregational Church, Tilton, New Hampshire. In 1877, I married Mr. Asa Giedi, and in 1878 was called to preach in Boston at the Baptist Tabernacle of the Reverend Daniel C. Eddy, D.D., by the pastor of that church, the Reverend Joseph Williams. I accepted the call, and during my ministry there, the congregation so increased in number that the pews were not sufficient to seat the audience, and benches were used in the aisles. The following is my certificate of ordination as pastor of the First Church in the Christian Science denomination. This certifies that Mrs. Mary B. G. Eddy was ordained pastor of the Church of Christ, chartered in Massachusetts, 1879. She preached for us 3 years, and we reverence her Christian character and great ability to preach the gospel. While she was with us, she built up the church and society to a flourishing condition, and it is with a sincere sense of our obligations to her and with the most tender regrets that we give her up to enter upon new tasks. Per order of the church, H.P. Smith, Clark, Boston, December 28, 1880. Previous to my ordination, I had preached for the aforesaid society 3 years. Very sacred to me are the memories that cluster around my old home, the city of Lynn, bordering the birthplace of Christian Science. Through the generosity and thoughtfulness of the citizens of Lynn, the earthly dwelling where science and health, with key to the scriptures, was written, has been purchased and set aside as a memorial to those fruitful labours for the upbuilding of humanity, where my husband Dr. Eddie and I instituted the Christian Scientists' Home and passed many happy hours in prayer to God and work for man. Stages of advancements. After I had made the discovery in 1866 that all is mind, there is no matter, that mind included all that is real of man and the universe, this infinite subject had to be digested mentally and its method of practice comprehended by students before I could give it up to the public in a book. So immature was the general thought upon this topic, I did not venture to print my manuscript of Christian Science for several years after its discovery. Some of my first students waited to grow to the stature of my teaching and practice. These now can heal through prayer, for they understand that the sick are healed by divine power and by spiritual means wherein matter has no part. From 1866 to 1875, I myself was learning Christian Science, step by step, gradually developing the wonderful germ I had discovered as an honest investigator. It was practical evolution. I was reaching by experience and demonstration the scientific proof and scientific statement of what I had already discovered. My later teachings and writings show the steady growth of my spiritual idea during those pregnant years. After teaching my first class in Christian Science, the fact was proven that its demonstration rests wholly on a spiritual basis. Thereafter, my students conformed to this rule. I have faced the destiny of a discoverer and pioneer from first to last, had to unfold gradually the divine mystery, open to all but seen by almost none, according to his word. The method of practice for students perplexed me, although I healed through spiritual power the divine influx of truth. Students could not be taught up to the silent, effectual prayer that casts out evils and heals the sick till they receive the unction of the Spirit. This was as impractical as for a clergyman to make a sinner pray for himself effectually until he is moved by divine spirit to seek salvation. A preparation of the heart or the individual consciousness is requisite in both cases. In my revisions of Science and Health, its entire keynote has grown steadily clearer and louder and sweeter. Not a single vibration of its melodious strings has been lost. I have more and more clearly elucidated my subjects as year after year has flown. Until now, its claims may not be misunderstood. Was Newton capable of satisfactorily stating the laws of gravitation when first he discovered that ponderous principle? Much less could I, at first, formulate and express the infinite principle and the divine laws of which God gave me the first faint gleam in my hour of physical agony and mental illumination. All true Christian scientists realize to some extent my early honest struggles. I was not poor until I renounced my old faith and declined to write on any other subject. After I had left all to follow Christ, I was poor in this world's wealth for several years, but was growing rich in God's bestowals. I climbed the sun-crowned heights of Christian science through the illumined truths of Holy Writ and by precept and example. It required a deep study of the Scriptures, in the words of St. Paul, a life hid with Christ in God. And I am still kneeling at the feet of Christ. The sword is not used in defense of myself, for the new tongue is not yet generally understood. But my life, as well as teaching, has carried conviction to students and to the sick that God is doing the work whereof I speak. When reviled and persecuted, I revile not again, but wait on the ages to illumine his pages. In the chapter on fruitage, which appears in the 226th edition of my work, Science and Health, may be seen an inkling of the fruit of my labours. I look for no general comprehension of scientific metaphysical propositions at present. They must seem abstract to minds not touched by this divine fire. But the obvious fact is that all who do understand Christian science are invincible in their admiration of its Christ-like character, and demonstrate its truth, utility, and practicability every day. Christian science lays the axe at the root of the tree. It unfolds theodicy, which indicates the harmony of all, emanating from the divine mind, and the liability to err of any supposed opposite power, evil, occultism, animal magnetism, hypnotism. Dr. Asa G. Eddy attacked. A recent resurrection of the buried past compels me to repeat the following. In 1878, the court in Boston unearthed a foul conspiracy against the fair name of my husband. The press had sent throughout our land and abroad the statement that Dr. Asa G. Eddy had been arrested for conspiracy to murder one Daniel H. Spofford. At the same time, this so-called murdered man was well and hidden away in Boston. Reverend Russell Conwell, D.D. of Philadelphia, P.A. at that time, a prominent attorney in Boston, was Mrs. Eddy's counsel. The principal witness against him testified in court that Mr. Eddy gave him money and employed him to kill Spofford. Afterwards said, witness confessed that he lied, and said he never saw Mr. Eddy until he saw him in court. Mr. Eddy was Daniel H. Spofford's friend, and I his benefactor. He had helped Spofford, given him gratuitous use of his office, its furniture, and so forth. I am glad to say that I now believe Mr. Spofford was wronged and unwittingly drawn by his enemies into that conspiracy. Forever, to make plain the diabolism of this infamous proceeding, I append these extracts from the chapter on demonology in my third edition of Science and Health. The case was called in the Municipal Court, 1878. The principal witnesses for the prosecution were convicts and inmates of houses of ill fame in Boston. The detectives put the defendants into court, mainly relying on the testimony of one S, whose testimony was elaborate in detail. The principal point of his statement was that he met Dr. Eddy and Ahrens on a railroad track in East Cambridge on the 17th of August, 1878, at 5:30 p.m. to arrange for putting D.S. out of the way. He said he was certain of the time, having noted it by a seizure on a rum shop made at 5:30 on that day. Said he had placed the witness C in a freight car to hear whatever conversation might occur, so that his testimony should confirm his own. He further said he was paid money by E.J. Ahrens in Boston and by Dr. Eddy at his house in Lynn. The following affidavit, which was made before a justice in Taunton, Massachusetts, on the 17th of December, 1878, makes plain this wicked conspiracy. I, George A. Collier, do on oath depose and say of my own free will, and in order to expose the man who has tried to injure Dr. Asa G. Eddy and E.J. Ahrens, that S. did induce me, by great persuasion, to go with him to East Cambridge from Boston, on or about the 7th day of November last, the day of the hearing in the Municipal Court of Boston, in the case of Dr. Asa G. Eddy and E.J. Ahrens, for attempting to hire said S. to kill on D. S., and that he showed me the place and the cards that he was going to swear to, and told me what to say in court, and made me repeat the story until I knew it well, so that I could tell the same story that he would, and there was not one word of truth in it at all. I never heard a conversation in East Cambridge between said Eddy and Ahrens and S., or saw them pay or offer to pay S. any money. Signed, George A. Collier. The following affidavit is from one of the old and much respected citizens of Lynn. Lynn, May 12th, 1881. Detective P. stated in court, or before the grand jury, I think, that Mr. and Dr. Eddy were with him at number 8 Broad Street on a certain day, and paid him some money. While I can state that they were both at 71.5 Market Street, Lynn, all the afternoon of that day, and at the precise time testified to by said P, that he was with them at number 8 Broad Street. Mr. P has said to me that the testimonies of all the parties in the case were perjuries. Signed, David Austin. Personally appeared before me, the above-named David Austin, and acknowledged this to be his free act indeed. Signed, H.L. Bancroft, Notary Public. The editors of leading newspapers, who entertained no purpose to injure the cause of Christian healing, made honourable amends for the articles they had published. The following is taken from the Boston Evening Transcript, February 22, 1879. That conspiracy. The case brought by D. S. last October against Dr. Eddy and E. G. Ahrens of Lynn has been null pros apostrophe D. The confession under oath is one of the real conspirators, that he was employed to testify falsely, is supported by other direct evidence. He, Dr. Eddy, is a member of the Baptist Church and bears an excellent character. Mrs. Glover Eddy's most intimate acquaintances say her life and teachings are of the highest character. May the hour be not distant when the kindling rays of divine love shall lift the long night of ignorance, subtlety, and crime, flooding the world with light and establishing universal brotherhood, peace on earth and goodwill to men. The state removed the detectives that arrested my husband, and the other two principal witnesses were taken to jail on previous charges. A public dinner was tendered to Dr. Asa G. Eddy, and everything possible was done to make amends for the unjust prosecution. A law relating to libel was also immediately passed to prevent the recurrence of similar outrages. Soon after, we were settled in our new home on Columbus Avenue, Boston, and I had established the Massachusetts Metaphysical College. I suggested to my husband that he take a brief respite from his labours, and shall never forget his answer. Mary, I cannot leave you alone with all these burdens upon you, and then to be away from you would be akin to death. My legal counsel at the time, I employed them, have been able and honourable members of the bar. Only one has lost his high standing, and this about 8 years after I had left Boston and stopped employing them. Infringement of science and health. No bygone history of the dead would ever be reproduced by me, were it not drawn out by falsehoods published concerning it. A decision of the United States Circuit Court at Boston affords further evidence upon this subject. I quote from an article in the Journal of Christian Science of October 6, 1883. The article is entitled Infringement of Science and Health, etc. Decision of the United States Circuit Court. The decision was based upon a proceeding instituted by Mrs. Eddy against one Edward J. Ahrens to restrain him from publishing a pamphlet printed and issued by him, which for the most part contained matter pirated from the works of Mrs. Mary Baker Eddy. Sometime later, the said Ahrens, having published another pamphlet differing a little from the first one, the bill was amended to include this second piracy. Ahrens, in his answer, alleged that the copyrighted works of Mrs. Eddy were not original with her, but had been copied by her, or by her direction, from manuscripts originally composed by Dr. P.P. Quimby. The time for taking testimony on the part of the defendant Ahrens having nearly expired, he gave notice through his counsel that he should not put in any testimony, and a stipulation for a judgment and decree in favour of Mrs. Eddy was drawn up and signed by his counsel. Miscellaneous Writings, page 381, referring to the failure on the part of defendant Ahrens' counsel to introduce proof in support of his answer, says Mrs. Eddy requested her lawyer to inquire of defendant's counsel why he did not present evidence to support his claim that Dr. Quimby was the author of her writings. Accordingly, her counsel asked the defendant's counsel this question, and he replied in substance, "There is no evidence to present." Upon the filing of this stipulation, the following decree was made by the court. Circuit Court of the United States, District of Massachusetts, decree for a perpetual injunction. September 24th, 1883. It is ordered, adjudged, and decreed as follows, that the copyright heretofore obtained by the complainant under the name of Mary Baker Glover upon the book entitled The Science of Man, etc., and the copyright upon the book entitled Science and Health, Volume 2, by Mary Baker Glover Eddy, whereby there was secured good and valid copyrights, that the said defendant has infringed the said copyrights, and upon the exclusive rights of the complainant under the same, by publication, sale, and distribution of the works, the understanding of Christianity or God, etc., and Christianity or the understanding of God, etc., by Edward J. Ahrens. And it is further ordered, adjudged, and decreed that a perpetual injunction be issued against the defendants according to the prayer of the bill. And it is further ordered, etc., that the complainant recover of the defendant her cost of suit taxed at $113.09. 113 and 9 of $100 by the court. Alex H. Trowbridge, Deputy Clerk. And upon such decree, the following injunction was issued and served upon E.J. Ahrens. United States of America, Massachusetts District, SS, the President of the United States of America to Edward J. Ahrens of Boston in the state of Massachusetts, your agents and servings, send greetings. Whereas Mary B.J. Eddy of said Boston has exhibited her bill of complaint before the justices of our circuit courts of the United States for the First Circuit, begun and holden at Boston, within and for the District of Massachusetts on the 15th day of May, A.D., 1883, against you, the said Edward J. Ahrens, praying to be relieved touching the matters therein complained of, whereas by an order from said court, made on the 24th day of September, A.D. 1883, it was ordered that a writ of injunction issue under seal of the said court to restrain you, and each and every of you, from doing all the matters and things, from the doing of which you are prayed to be restrained in said bill, according in full with the prayer of said bill. We therefore, in consideration thereof, enjoin and command you, each and every of you, that from And immediately after the receipt of notice of this, our writ, by you, or any of you, you shall not directly or indirectly print, publish, sell, give away, distribute, or in any way or manner dispose of a certain work or book entitled The Understanding of Christianity or God, etc., by Edward J. Arons, or a certain book or book entitled Christianity or The Understanding of God, etc., by Edward J. Arons, which said books are copied from and infringements of the copyrighted works of the complainant as set forth in the bill of complaint in this case. Whereof you are not to fail on pain of $10,000 to be levied on your and each of your goods, chattels, lands, and tenements to our use. Witness, the Honourable Morrison R. Waite at Boston, this 27th day of September, in the year of our Lord 1883. Alex H. Trowbridge, Deputy Clerk, United States of America, Massachusetts District, Boston, October 4th, 1883. I hereby acknowledge personal service of the within injunction, Edward J. Arons. Concerning this decree, the editor of the Christian Science Journal said, "It seems scarcely necessary to add that Mr. Arons' defense, as set forth in his answer, having been that the works, the copyright of which he infringed, were not original with Mrs. Eddy, he would, had it been possible, have produced the proof necessary to support his answer. It is evident this defense was vital in the case, as he apparently had no other. The fact that he failed to produce his proof is conclusive evidence that no such proof existed. No honest or disinterested person in the face of this record would undertake to falsify the record by insisting that Mrs. Eddy's works were plagiarized from Dr. Quimby's writings. The absurdity as well as the utter falsity of this claim are at once apparent. Let us hope that, as a mere matter of self-respect, if for no other reason, the person now lending themselves to this circulation of the falsehood will awaken to their error and see that they are merely stultifying themselves. Never to my knowledge did I prosecute Spofford for mental malpractice. Mr. Arons had been heard to say Spofford ought to be prosecuted for mental malpractice on Miss Brown, and through proceedings unknown to me, he may have used my name in some way without my authority. As, for example, on another occasion, Arons asked me for a note of $1,000 that a student had given me and which I had never tried to collect. He said if I would give it to him, he would collect it without legal proceedings.